You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, have you ever wondered why there are so many trolls roaming around the village of Mount Horeb? We get some answers and learn whether they're the good kind of trolls or the not-so-good kind. Now, you might have heard of farm to table, but what about grain to glass? Beer has a long and complex history in our state. Old World Wisconsin is exploring that history and actually making beer from historic recipes that visitors can taste on site. Rob Novak is the Brewing Experience Program Coordinator at Old World of Wisconsin. Rob, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a taste of what we'll experience when we visit the Brewing Experience?
Yeah, so what you'll find is the newest building on site, which is actually brewing some of the oldest beer in the state. And what we have is a beautiful space to really do some experimental beer archaeology with the tools and techniques that farmers would have had in Wisconsin from 1850 or 1860 to about 1900.
I think when people think of Wisconsin beer, they think of the big brand names that came along after this time period you're talking about. What was the beer scene like in Wisconsin before those big names kind of took over?
Well, it really wasn't too different than it is today, where we have small breweries in almost every town. Back then, they would have had small production breweries, mostly German, so the variety would not be the same. But they had small breweries, and you got to remember that they couldn't send beer long distances until they had refrigerated rail cars. So every town had to have a brewery. Before that time, farmers themselves did the brewing. So no matter where they were from, they had their own beer traditions, and they try to recreate them in their kitchens.
How do you go about finding these old beer recipes?
The recipes are tricky. We know the styles and we know how they've evolved. Every once in a while, we'll find a recipe that falls out of a book or that we can find in a very old journal or something like that. But for the most part, we look at the ingredients they would have had, the time of year they would have been brewing, where they were from. And we do have to kind of piece them together and kind of reverse engineer them to try to get the flavors that they experienced.
I've known homebrewers, and even though they're doing it on a small scale, they're taking advantage of modern technology in some ways. What are some of the maybe fundamental differences of an 1800s homebrewer? What are some of the challenges that they might face, that you might face, trying to do it the way they did?
Well, they would have needed to provide all their own ingredients. So they're growing the barley, mostly barley. They're malting it themselves. They're growing the hops, or they're using other spices, other herbs to spice their beers. And while yeast wasn't fully understood yet, they were using yeast, but they would have gotten it from a neighbor, or they would have used maybe a baker's yeast in some cases. So really it was just ingenuity, farmer's ingenuity to create the beverage. The tools they would have used would have been either handcrafted or utilized for other purposes most of the time. But it's really all those factors coming together to make beer.
Rob Novak is with us, director of the Brewing Experience at Old World Wisconsin, telling us about making beers like Wisconsin made them back in the 1800s. Can you tell us about a couple of the brews you've been working on, Rob?
Well, one that we brew often is a cream ale, and that recipe was revived by craft brewers recently because you're basically brewing with ale ingredients and ale yeast, but you're making a beer that has lager-like flavors, and that's because the German immigrants coming here wouldn't have had access to lager yeast immediately. So they would have used a lot of corn as a clean fermenting, light fermenting grain. Of course, corn is now used in a lot of American adjunct beers. But back then, it would have been used as a primary ingredient to try to lighten the beer, to make it more like the beer they remembered from home.
Where do you source your ingredients to try to recreate some of these older recipes?
Well, we grow our own hops here. We have five or six varieties growing, and we will add to that. Once we finish the next phase of the project, it will include a hop garden that has a lot of varieties, including some wild Wisconsin hops. We're planting a field of heirloom barley. It's going to take a few years to get enough seed. We'll have to replant it and then harvest it and then partner with the local maltster to malt it. Heirloom barley was a lot smaller. It was unmodified. Today's barleys are made for brewing, but the barley back then would have been trickier. For the yeast, we tend to reharvest, or we'll go to a local brewery and ask if we can snag some of their ale yeast from whatever they're brewing. And we put all those things together and we make it work.
I'm going to throw a long shot out here for you, Rob. Suppose somebody's listening and says, you know, there's this old family diary or whatever where great-great-grandparents had their beer recipe. Do you want to see that if they have that?
Yeah, we definitely want to see it. Those are the funnest things. A lot of times the language is different, or there's measurements that are strange depending on where people are from. But yeah, because that, even if it's from Prohibition, it gives us a link to what was being brewed before then. And if we can start linking those together, we might be able to actually figure out what beer tasted like in 1860 and 1870. That's the big mystery. Once these things are consumed, it's all like maybe music back then. You just have no idea. It's a big mystery, and we're trying to solve that.
Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
That's Rob Novak, director of the Brewing Experience at Old World Wisconsin, talking about his efforts to recreate Wisconsin beers of the 1800s. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about embracing new experiences.
Writer Jill Sisson Quinn and her son had a summer routine. They would go to their local lake for a chilly early morning swim almost every day. But last summer, they tried somewhere new. The experience opened Quinn's eyes to the joys of both new and old loves.
My go-to lake is Sunset in Portage County, a few minutes from my home. When my son was an infant, I planted his feet in its warm sand. I pushed him on the swing while he alternately dozed and watched green darners, belted kingfishers, and bald eagles. Even as, over the years, Sunset's water level rose, swallowing the beach, engulfing the swing set, and turning the picnic tables into strange diving platforms, we continued our near-daily summer visits. They began in late May, when I'd returned from my morning walk to my son waiting on the porch in his swim trunks. We'd arrive at Sunset before 8 a.m., alone but for one older couple who braved the icy water with us. But last summer, I cheated on Sunset. I enrolled my son in swimming lessons at Waupaca County's Shadow Lake, a farther drive to a more populated area. Shadow seemed a little less wild, with its slides, lifeguards, freeze pops, and flushable toilets. The water was more shallow and warm. Folks warned by summer's end there might be lots of goose poop. Cars ran visibly along a fairly busy road on the lake's western side. Because of this, I assumed there was a dam somewhere, and the lake was man-made. Gradually, we fell in love with Shadow. I watched the teenage swim instructors progress from organizing games of hula hoop tag to teaching my son the crawl. They showed him how to give himself over to the water, how a quick turn of the head and in-breath is all he really needs of a landed environment. There is something so right about watching high schoolers teach younger kids. A friend once summed it up for me. Teenagers so need to be loved, and children so love teenagers. We didn't visit Sunset for weeks. My son found a lost beach ball in the wetlands east of Shadow, and thus began pickup games of soccer before lessons. After class, he would play on the raft and the slide with whoever was there, girls and boys alike of varying ages, who barely knew each other's names, brought together by this lake. Some pretty natural things can happen at an unnatural lake, I left thinking one day, musing about my shifting love from Sunset to Shadow. But Shadow Lake is not man-made. Like Sunset, it formed in a kettle depression left by the retreat of the last glacier, where a huge chunk of ice gradually melted in the newly laid sediment. The lake's only difference is how they get their water. A hardwater seepage lake, Sunset's water comes mainly from groundwater. A drainage lake, Shadow has both an outlet and inlet, and receives water from precipitation, runoff, and another nearby lake. And both lakes have had humans' hands in them, suffered and benefited from our constant remodeling of the environment. Shadow Lake has had its channels renovated. Sunset has endured chemicals to kill off its entire fish population to be replaced with more desirable species. This reminds me that categories exist mostly in the mind. Natural, man-made, seepage, drainage, the lines between them often blurry. Nothing is pure. Passions can shift, and our preconceived ideas about one thing over another only limit our experience. After his final lesson, my son and I returned to Sunset Lake, and that original bond flooded through me like a dream of one's first love, from which you wake thinking still, this many years later, that was the one. and sunset seemed to forgive our fickleness. That day, unassisted for the first time, my son would swim all the way out to sunset's buoy, just him and the water and desire. And for that, I cannot deny, I have to thank Shadow.
Jill Sisson Quinn is an author who teaches writing at Mid-State Technical College and lives in Scandinavia, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we answer a Wisconsin listener question about trolls and Norwegian culture in the village of Mount Horeb. That's coming up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, we recently received this Wisconsin question from a listener.
Hi, my name is Leah Jaber. I'm a senior at Madison East High School, and my question is, how exactly did Mount Horeb become the troll capital of the world, and is the Norwegian culture still so alive and prevalent?
Central Time producer Tim Peterson visited the troll capital itself to get the story, and you'll be able to hear audio from that visit in a forthcoming Wisconsin Life piece. He also talked to Jim Leary, Emeritus Professor of Folklore and Scandinavian Studies at UW-Madison. Jim co-founded the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. He also happens to be a Mount Horeb resident since the late 1980s. Here's a listen to their conversation.
So, Jim, let's start with answering the second question first. When did the village of Mount Horeb become a center for Norwegian culture in Wisconsin?
Mount Horeb was a strong area of Norwegian settlement in the mid-19th century, along with the Koshkonong Prairie and around Stoughton, and Mount Horeb and the hinterland surrounding it and extending out to Blue Mounds was also an area of concentrated early Norwegian settlement. And then there was a kind of a second wave in the late 19th century with newcomers sometimes coming to work as hired workers for the more settled Norwegians. So it's right there in a kind of a little belt of historic Norwegian settlement.
And we're going to get to trolls, obviously, but what are some other elements of Norwegian culture that someone would see if they walk around or spend time in Mount Horeb?
Well, the face of the village has a lot that says Norwegian. On the east end, there's a big water tower with Rosmaling, this stylized Norwegian floral painting, and there are banners on the light standards through the village that have Rosmaling motifs and sometimes Velkommen, you know, welcome in Norwegian. The little Chamber of Commerce building on the main street, and also the old kind of railroad depot rest area on what is now the bike trail, have motifs from Stavkirke or stave churches, wooden churches. And then there's the prominent open house imports, the Scandinavian gift shop with trolls out front, and also a stabur, a Norwegian log storage building that Nels Diller made.
And that's, you know, things that we could see if we walked around today, but are there kind of things that were erected by these immigrants that you mentioned earlier and that are kind of still around, or has there been sort of a reimagining or trying to come back to that those cultural items in later times?
Well, both, really. You know, there is what specialists refer to as intangible cultural heritage, the stuff that, you know, is ephemeral, or you don't, it's not a building or something like that. So people having coffee saying expressions like ufta, these expressions of kind of amazement or exasperation, you know, telling an occasional oli en line yolk, and you know, slipping into dialect. There were old customs like julevaking, this kind of Christmas masquerading that used to happen well into the 1950s and early 60s in and around Mount Horeb, of dressing up and in disguise and barging in on your neighbors. There's a strong Sons of Norway lodge. There's Norwegian Lutheran presence in several of the Lutheran churches. So all of that stuff is kind of intangible or behind the scenes, and you know, you have to experience it by being around. But then, you know, there's this public face. And so, you know, Mount Horeb, there are Swiss people, there are Germans, there are Irish, there are Cornish in the historical settlement, but a plurality of Norwegians. And of course, outside the village was Little Norway, a longstanding tourist site. And for maybe 30 years or so into the 90s, a little village pageant, Song of Norway, based on the life of Edvard Grieg, who composed, among other things, in the Hall of the Mountain King, with trolls. And so, you know, those kinds of public-facing elements that say Norwegian were there, and in the way that people associate New Glarus with Swiss identity, for example, there are these community identities that sometimes tie in with ethnicity, and Mount Horeb has chosen to promote Norwegianness.
We're talking with Jim Leary, Professor Emeritus of Folklore and Scandinavian Studies at UW-Madison, also a longtime Mount Horeb resident himself, and we're answering a Wisconsin question about Mount Horeb, its Norwegian culture, and its trolls. So, Jim, remind us from folklore, what exactly is a troll?
Well, trolls are these ugly and somewhat dim-witted and physically powerful ancient figures who are associated with Norway's pagan past, and often its environment, you know, dwelling in caves and mountains, and sometimes in forests. And they also tie in with other creatures, so-called Undurjordiske, these underground people, among them the Huldur, the hidden people who sometimes have the appearances of good-looking human beings, but they have the tails of cows. And so, you know, there are different figures associated with the Norwegian landscape. And if you're out there and, you know, barging into their territory, in the case of trolls, you might be taken into the mountain, or mm-hmm. they might come and raid your place if you're encroaching on theirs.
And so, I mean, that doesn't really sound like something you'd want to have lining the streets of your town necessarily, but that's the case in Mount Horeb. How did Mount Horeb actually become the troll capital officially of the world?
Well, that's, of course, a self-anointed regal title. But in the 70s, folks in Mount Horeb were realizing that the construction of the 18-151 bypass would route traffic away from their town, and how could they get people to come in? And so there was a meeting of minds about what kind of theme to emphasize, and they did surveys, and Norwegianness seemed to be something that they could ballyhoo a little bit. And then there's the clever play on words between tollway and trollway, so you could take the troll way, you know, off of the main highway. And trolls, of course, have this long association with Norway. And they were particularly popularized in 19th century illustrated collections of folk tales by P.C. Asbjørnsen and Jørgen Mue. So the troll became this, in the 19th and early 20th century, this kind of visible symbol of Norwegian folklore, and people in Mount Horeb could draw on it. But you know, you have this distance in time and space, and so, you know, the terrifying creature of the past that you might recoil from in horror becomes something, you know, friendly and cuddly, and little children want little troll toys with a goofy hair and rubbery skin, rather than running away from them as sources of terrible nightmares.
And Jim, I have to ask you, do you have a favorite troll around Mount Horeb?
Ah, you know, I love Mike Feeney's old troll carvings.
Yes.
And then there was a magnificent person, Oleana Venden Kanin, mm-hmm. and she used to make little troll sculptures out of Sculpey and coat hangers, and she would make clothing for them. She also made Barbie clothes on the side, but she made them for people in the different professions in Mount Horeb. And so there'd be one in the barbershop and one in the dentist office and, you know, a dentist troll and a butcher shop troll. And I loved her work as well.
Mm. Jim, thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
My pleasure.
That was Jim Leary, Emeritus Professor of Folklore and Scandinavian Studies at UW-Madison. Central Time producer Tim Peterson talked to them about the history and prevalence of Norwegian culture in the village of Mount Horeb and why they've got such a thing for trolls. This conversation came from an audience question as part of the Why Scotson question. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Why Scotson. That's like W-H-Y Scotson. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at the controversy surrounding a potential visit to Taiwan by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Now, we often celebrate creativity, but what if you're just not the creative type? Well, it's true that a lot of us may never paint a timeless painting or compose a symphony, but our next guest says you may not be giving yourself enough credit for the less obvious ways that your creativity comes out. And he says creative people aren't just born that way. You can learn to be more creative, too. We're listening back to that conversation now, and we want to hear from you. What does creativity look like in your life? Has the pandemic led you to be more creative in your parenting, staying connected to loved ones, or how you have fun? Have you tried new ways to be creative? How often do you go outside of your comfort zone? Email centraltime@WPR.org. That's centraltime@WPR.org. Or tweet us @centraltimeWPR. Matt Richtel is a science reporter for the New York Times. His latest book is called Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. He joined the show earlier this year. You've followed this subject for a long time. I've talked to you a little bit about creativity in the past. What is so interesting to you about figuring out our creativity?
Well, I'll give you a quick answer, and then I want to ask you a question and maybe ask Uh-oh. Listeners to do the same thing. Oh, yeah.
I ask the questions here.
How come I can't be the host? That seems more creative. Do you ever have that feeling where you get an idea mm-hmm. and then you are inspired? You think it might be the best idea you've ever heard. You're in a vacuum of inspiration and you're just going to go for it. Does that resonate?
Not the best idea, but yeah, sometimes I think I got a pretty good idea.
You got a pretty good idea. Well, for whatever reason, sometime in after my 20s, I started getting hit with all these ideas. I created a syndicated comic strip and wrote 10 books and wrote a bunch of songs and whatever's happened at the New York Times. And I started to get interested in what that feeling was that drives so many people. And so I looked to science and I looked to great creators in the book. I talked to Yo-Yo Ma, Judd Apatow, Steve Kerr of the Warriors, you know, go down the list of all these great creators to figure out, is there something biological and fundamental about creativity? And what the heck is it?
I want to spoil the answer here, but yes, it sounds like if I read you right, there is something in our, like as humans, in our DNA that makes creativity happen. Like you talk to scientists, why would we evolve to have this creativity?
Yeah. And I even went all the way into the lab looking at bacteria and how they respond when bombarded by a threat and how they create their way out of the situation. And without giving so much of it away, discovered ultimately that there is a deep biological underpinning to our creative urges and then traced that forward to how that plays out in our own lives.
All right. So we got little kids. They're creative as heck. We all are. But you write about something you call the fourth grade slump. What happens to us in fourth grade?
Yeah, I went and looked at this research that started about in the 1950s, where researchers were trying to figure out what makes us creative and what hampers our creativity. And it was a period of time, Rob, where we were beginning to ask as a society, what is this thing called creativity? We value it a lot. Why does it seem so elusive? And here's why. When you're a little kid, ideas flow through you without judgment. Somewhere around fourth grade, the research shows creative explosions start to actually diminish. Now, why would that be? Well, it's right around this time that young people begin to internalize rules before they internalize impulses. So, Rob, when you're raising kids as I'm doing, and I don't know what your situation is, I promise not to ask any deeply personal questions.
I got a pair of them, first year of college.
You
now.
Got a pair. Okay, so do these sentences resonate? Don't run into the street. Don't pick your nose and eat it.
Careful
don't
on
eat
the
that
steps.
Off the floor. Tons of no's. And what it does is it conditions people to begin to say no before they begin to say yes. What is the rule that would impair me or interfere with me before I go forward? Here's the problem. Creativity at its core is an act of permission. It begins with allowing your mind to flow with ideas, oftentimes ideas that are against the status quo, against the rule system, run afoul of something you've heard. So you are conditioned from a very young age to begin to shut those down.
How do we break out of those rules?
Yeah, to be plain, this is not precisely a health self-help book. This is more of a scientific journey, but I can't deny that in the end, the questions you ask are the very ones I sought to answer myself. And there are a bunch of tools we can use. I'll give you a couple of examples without going over all the studies in the book. One of them has to do with mind wandering. And believe it or not, this is something we often do and really dislike. So when people's mind wanders, actually, can I pause, Rob, and give you an exercise to explain what I mean by mind wandering?
Yeah, absolutely.
It will involve another deeply personal question.
Good, good.
Okay, here we go. Before you go to bed at night, don't kick me off the air.
I'm with you so far.
I'll say that I have these fantasies. I'm not talking about, those kind of fantasies. I'm talking about various ideas that pop in my head and flow through my mind. I had a friend, for example, explain she likes to imagine herself flying. When I was a kid, I used to imagine myself in a sporting goods store where I could buy anything I wanted. Our family didn't have much money. Do you have anything like that you used to think about or think about before bed?
Oh, yeah, sure. But it's better if I just drift into it, though, than consciously think about it. I mean, there's different things. I like board games. I think about those a lot. I'll say
all kinds of things. Okay. Now, you may not think about that as mind wandering. You may not have think of that in any way as a creative impulse. But when those ideas flow through your mind without filter, that's a little bit what mind wandering feels like. Here's the thing that the research shows. It shows, one, that when your mind wanders, you often come up with ideas that may elude you otherwise. And in fact, I can cite in a second, if you want, how some great creators use that. But just for a second, take it on face. The problem, though, is that when people's mind wanders, they often stop it when they're in the middle of their day, because mind wandering sometimes goes to worry. And people feel they're being unproductive. So to cultivate that idea of permission means cultivating this idea of mind wandering and giving it a little bit more breath than we often do.
We're talking to Matt Richtel about his new book, Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. Let's bring out a caller at 800-642-1234. Jordan is with us in Antigo. Jordan, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on this afternoon.
What did you want to tell us about?
I attended a seminar working with youth programming and youth groups, and the presenter was talking about creativity in that mindset. And the point that he brought up was very interesting, is that creativity is not something you have to dredge up out of yourself. If you think of creativity as being an expectation plus a modification. And the example that he used was soccer. Two teams, one ball, two goals. That's the expectation. But now what happens when you add a second ball, or you add two more teams and two more goals, or two more goals but keep the same number of teams? And all of a sudden you have this tree of possibilities that to the outsider looks spontaneous and creative, but really it's just the two simple phases of an expectation and a modification.
Jordan, thanks for that call. Matt, that reminds me, in your book, you talked to a group of young folks and gave them a, you know, take a normal thing and what if. What was their answer? Something like, what if you flush the toilet and it traveled you into space or something to that effect? Yeah. Is there something what our caller is saying there?
Well, there's a few things I love about Jordan's call, but I want to tell him a visceral reaction I had and explain what the science is behind it. So when he said two balls, I was like, well, no, you can't do two balls in soccer. And here's some great science. It turns out, and this was a piece that appeared in the New York Times today that excerpted from the book about why we often resist creative ideas. So explicitly, we often say, I want to be creative. I want to hire someone who's creative. But there is an implicit note, but studies will show that when they look at our subconscious feelings about creativity, they're very different than the feelings we say we have. And in fact, we subconsciously associate creativity with toxins and vomit and poison. Well, why would that be? To trace it back to Jordan's question, when we challenge the status quo, it means that we're going to have to change the way we conceptualize something. We may have to change our activities, our actions. We may have to change our whole lifestyle. And in fact, Rob, creativity often is very disruptive. So it's worth noting that we have these reactions internally that sometimes get in the way of our creativity because secretly we harbor visceral concerns about it.
We're listening back to a conversation we had with Matt Richtel, author of the book Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. We want to hear about your creativity story. When do you feel the most creative? Is it in your job, a hobby, some other part of life, maybe your relationships? Did you find more time during the pandemic to try something new? Do you feel more creative now than in the past? Let us know. Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. Or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. That's the song From Darkness, written and sung by our guest, Matt Richtel. We're talking to him about his new book, Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an example of how you use creativity in your life? Do you feel like you got to have some kind of creative outlet? Do you feel like you've lost it at some point? And have you ever solved a problem when you stopped thinking about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, there you are, Matt, writing a song and singing the song. You write fiction. You mentioned a comic strip. You're a science writer. That's your day job. And a lot of us might think, okay, I'm going to stay in my lane and not try all this stuff. Why encourage us to do some of the things you've done and branch out like that?
Oh, get out of your lane, baby. And if anybody wants to hear that full song, my email is mattrichtel@gmail.com, and I will send it to you. And I am, do I want to say I'm proud of it or I believe in it? Listen, believe in yourself. But let's guide me a little bit, Rob. Where do you want me to take this?
Like, so how can we, like songwriting, I'm a musician, right? And I feel pretty good about my musical output. I am a god-awful songwriter. I have no... I tried once. The world didn't need to hear it. How could you tell somebody in that situation, yeah, Rob, go back and try writing another song? Everybody's got probably something similar to that, that they're just... they'd be too embarrassed to share it with the world.
This is my... well, let me start with some science and come back to that answer.
Yeah.
One of the... because you alluded to this before. Another interesting study. This one looked at... artists, musicians, and physicists, and asked them to write down what they were doing when they solved a problem that they were trying, a creative problem they were trying to solve. And 20% of the time, they solved it when they weren't actively thinking about it. Now, that number may not seem so high, but the researcher said to me, how many things can you point to that you actually do at your very best when you're not trying? This is an idea that came to me from a variety of creators I talked to. Gary Trudeau, who created Doonesbury, gets his ideas in the shower, and Jane Pauley, his wife, keeps a pad of paper by her bed and scribbles down the ideas when she wakes up. Salvador Dali and Einstein used to take a nap with a rock or heavy object in their hands, and when they woke up, they would have an idea at the tip of their minds. The researcher calls it a hypnagogic state between wakefulness and sleep. To answer your question, Rob, if you sat down to say, I'm going to write a song right now, I think that's putting yourself in a very difficult position. If you were to carry with yourself the idea that I'm playing with music right now and I am open to song ideas coming to me, eventually I feel very certain they would emerge. And here's why. Over time, Rob, you have internalized the shape of a song. That is not elusive to you. Verse, chorus, or verse, verse, chorus, verse, chorus. Moreover, you know how long it is, 3.5 minutes, and you know that you're probably going to use 1, 4, and 5. Sorry, those are chord progressions for those of you listening. So a lot of this has been solved. I say put it in the back of your mind and see what happens.
Excellent. Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Joy is with us in Monona. Joy, hi.
How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Joy?
Good. I have a question that I'm going to try to make succinct. It's kind of a large area, but I'm wondering if Matt, your guest, has looked into or studied morphic resonance. It's a concept brought up by Rupert Sheldrake, an English thinker in, I think, the 60s. And anyway, it's about the concept that there's a kind of a universal unconsciousness or unconscious in the world, and that is where ideas come from. It's called morphic resonance, and it's really fascinating. And two quick examples to give you an idea of how this works is that there's records of researchers working with different kinds of monkeys around the world, and they were trying to get, one study was trying to get a matriarch to take her bananas down to the water and wash them, and then, you know, hopefully her whole clan would follow suit. Well, she wouldn't do it. She refused. But then around the world, they started getting calls from researchers saying, what's going on? Our monkey, like our matriarch, our alpha male, female is taking her bananas down to water and washing them before she eats them. And now the whole group is doing that.
Joy, thanks for the example. We don't have a ton of time, but Matt, I'm not familiar with that idea, but the general idea that there is this pool of ideas out there that any of us might tap into at a given moment.
Yeah. I mean, I actually think Joy brings up a really interesting point without having studied that particular language, and I'll tie it to some science I can validate for you. There have been periods of time in human history where specific areas of the world have been really rich with creativity. Jerusalem at the year zero, Harlem, Russia, Florence, France, Silicon Valley, Hollywood. What the research will bear out is that when you have certain connections among people that are dense, you wind up getting cooperation, collaboration, competition, and ideas are in the air that really intensify the creative process. Now, that may not sound like the same thing as what Joy's describing, but in a way, it's a more physical description of how the subconscious becomes flowing through a population. I would just add, Rob, that you could make a pretty good case that we are at the most creative period in human history. And one of the reasons for that is that technology is allowing those ideas to be shared across borders, among people, across interest groups and niches. Just listen to this simple statistic. In 2018, there were 144,000 patents applied for by international collaborators. That's a little less than double from the number in 2000. So we're seeing an explosion of that kind of cooperation across the globe.
We were talking to Matt Richtel about his new book out today called Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. Matt, earlier you mentioned that deep down, a lot of us are actually kind of scared of creativity, of novelty, of having to change the way we do things. So if someone is in charge of something, a teacher, a business manager, whatever, and they think they want creativity, how do they actually create a setting where people do get to be creative and run with it?
I just want to say that is a hugely great question that vexes scholars. And they will say that the middle managers are in one of the toughest positions and managers in all of the world. In fact, some of the research will show that when people are most in need of solutions, they're least able to accept them because the status quo feels safe at a time of great uncertainty. And so I think what it requires in the first instance is an acknowledgement that there must be a safe space for the expression of those ideas wherein the manager or leader agrees not to feel threatened by what happens. And some of those ideas will be terrible. In fact, one of the lessons of the biology of creativity and of creativity itself is that the most creative people, Einstein and Mozart and lots of others, were much better at quantity than they were at quality. There's a terrific story about Einstein that I heard where he says to a colleague, I've got it. I've got the unified field theory. And the colleague says, Albert, that's terrific, except under that theory, the universe can't exist. And people who create a lot come up with a lot of ideas, and some of them are terrible, and others are too scary, and some of them are just right, if you like your Three Bears analogy. And so that's what I would encourage leaders to create a safe space and recognize that quantity is where quality comes from.
It's a great place to leave it. Matt, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was New York Times science journalist Matt Richtel. We listened back to our conversation from earlier this year about his book, Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. Coming up after the news, find out how House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's potential trip to Taiwan next month has highlighted some of the current tensions between the U.S. and China. Look at those tensions, what they could mean for our economy as well. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.